This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Red states, blue wave, phrases we hear all the time, now in America. But on election night in 1984, news anchors had to explain to viewers why they were coloring certain states on the map red and certain ones blue.
The red states are states that we have projected having gone for Mr. Reagan. Red R. Reagan. That's why we chose red.
Explained in detail there by the network news. Now, fast forward to election night 16 years later. A far more dramatic event. The 2000 presidential race was the closest the country had ever seen.
Stand by, stand by. CNN right now is moving our earlier declaration of Florida back to the too close to call column.
That is the night back in 2000 when red and blue earned their meanings in American politics. The night when Florida was blue, then it was too close to call, and then it was red, then unknown again, then the Chad started to hang, then Bush v. Gore. It's also the night, according to our guest Steve Kornacki, when our increasingly divisive politics came to a head and established America's polarized identity as the red and the blue. In fact, that is the name of his new book, The Red and the Blue, the 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. We'll talk with Steve about how the 90s paved the way for today's political reality right after you hear this.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Grow with Google. Digital skills are becoming more and more important in today's economy. That's why Grow with Google is providing free online training and tools to help Americans learn the skills they need to succeed. Learn more about Grow with Google and get started by visiting google.com/grow.
Would you put on a sweater that once belonged to Hitler? Can Chinese zodiac signs predict who's going to be a great scientist? And what happens when you use a training method for dogs to teach doctors? Answers to all those questions on my podcast, Hidden Brain.
Steve Kornacki, MSNBC and NBC News national political correspondent, and he's in the studio with me. Steve, it's a pleasure to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Steve, we're going to talk a lot about fascinating political history. We're also going to talk about where we are now in our politics, our electoral politics, the House, the Senate, the Kavanaugh hearings, which have captivated America, and the undercurrents of the politics there. But let's go back to 2000, because we just took a dip into those memories of hanging chads and Bush v. Gore and the recount in Florida and the Supreme Court deciding the results of an election. That's where your book begins and also where it ends. Why was that such a pivotal moment for political ideology in America?
I think it's the 2000 election to me, which is, you know, as close to a perfect tie, I think, as we're ever going to see in a presidential election. It was the perfect culmination of the 90s, all of the political wars of the 1990s, Bill Clinton, Newt Gingrich, Hillary Kerr, Ross Perot, Pitchfork Pat Buchanan, impeachment, all of these major battles, these major forces that shaped politics created this division that when you looked at that map on election night 2000 and you saw the entire South was now painted red, red for Republicans, the entire Northeast minus New Hampshire barely was painted blue for Democrats, the Pacific Coast. You could see these stark geographic boundaries, and they were more than geographic. They were cultural boundaries. They were demographic boundaries. And I think the 90s really, to me, it's the decades those colors synced up with the parties. Those colors took on partisan meaning, political meaning, and people chose sides. And it's almost that two tribes were formed, red and blue. And I think that framework that was created that night, that was produced by the 90s, is basically the framework we have been living with ever since.
And at that time, red and blue were, let's face it, convenient network news sort of map ways to follow. Okay, Colorado voted for Reagan and California voted for Carter or Mondale.
Right.
So you got your head around it. Then they became to mean so much more. For a lot of years in this country, we had red. We got it. We had blue. We tried out purple for a long time. Oh, there's a purple. There are states or people that are independent. They're in between. They could swing either way. You hear a lot less about even purple now. And red and blue don't just mean who voted for whom on a map on NBC News. They mean a whole lot more. They mean identity.
Exactly. When I say, you know, cultural, demographic, identity, here's the stat that really jumps out at me. In 2016, a poll was taken. They asked people who identify as Republicans, who identify as Democrats. They said, would you be upset if your child married a member of the other party? And it was more than 60% who said yes in each party. These are numbers you used to see for like interracial marriage.
Or religion.
And they're now, and they're now the numbers you get for, and that's the meaning that red and blue, that red America, blue America, red state, blue state, Democrat, Republican, that's the meaning it's taken on to people. It's that deep, it's that significant that the idea of their child, a Democrat marrying a Republican, it bothers them at that level now.
Why have we sorted in this way? People blame social media with its sorting proclivities. Yep. That has to be part of it. But a lot of this happened before Twitter or Facebook were really a thing. People blame Fox News and the siloing of information and I'm sorry, but MSNBC to an extent, I think less so, but they blame 24-hour cable news and the sorting effect there. What is it to you when you look at how red and blue transformed from how you vote to who you are?
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, it's true. The evolution of media, and just broadly speaking, media from, you know, 40 years ago when you were talking about ABC, CBS, NBC, that's basically it. And then you get your local newspaper, and local newspapers were really strong back then. And that was it. To cable news channels, all sorts of cable channels, to entertainment programs that sort of have a fusion with politics now, political content, all over entertainment programming, all of the various online streaming platforms that are out there, they lend themselves to tribalism. So I think that's one of the factors. Another one that just kind of occurred to me when I looked at all of this was, I think as human beings, in some ways, we are hardwired for tribalism. And it was just sort of this almost a fluke of the way technology and the media had evolved that for so long, well into the 20th century, our politics didn't fully reflect that. And what we had really into the 1990s, and this is what the 90s, I think, sorted out, but heading into the 1990s, if you looked at the Democratic Party, you saw massive ideological diversity. You saw conservative Southerners sharing a party with big city liberals, you know, in the North. And if you looked at the Republican Party, you saw genuine liberals, liberal Republicans from the Northeast sharing a party with, you know, conservative isolationists from the Midwest and a Republican Party that was still just trying to sort of establish its footing in the South. It really got that in the 1990s, I would say. Within each party, there was very broad ideological geographic diversity, and it's, you almost look at the system, you look at the media around it, and it was almost waiting to be sorted out. And I think that's what the 90s did. It sorted it all out.
We'll look more at that history in the 90s, but let's not let the politicians themselves off the hook. Mm-hmm. How much of this was strategy? Because we're going to talk about some of the history of Reagan and Pat Buchanan. I don't mean to just single out Republicans, but I think it is historically accurate that a lot of the capitalization and sort of operationalizing of tribalism in politics started with the Southern strategy, started with Republicans who really said, we can define who our voters are, we can make them mad, we can make them identify with what they stand for when they tick an R candidate.
Well, and it was, look, the name that looms large in this, and it was, he just, whatever you think of him, is a fascinating character, is Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich obviously towers over the politics of the 90s, but the Gingrich story begins in 78 when he gets elected to Congress. And the Congress that Newt Gingrich comes to is one that is dominated by Democrats. At that point, it had been a generation since Republicans had controlled the House, and they weren't even close. And what Gingrich was looking at was he was looking at presidential election results. Richard Nixon in 1972 was able to win 49 states. And in 1980, Ronald Reagan wins 44. You say Republicans running as conservatives, certainly with Reagan, can win big nationally. The reason he's saying Republicans haven't been able to win in the House is they don't have that clear definition that a Ronald Reagan has, that clear contrast that a Ronald Reagan benefits from. And what Gingrich said was, we need to change the way we operate in the House as a Republican Party. The idea of compromising with Democrats, that tells voters there's no difference between us and the Democrats. The idea of working with them, the idea of partisan warfare as a tool to mobilize voters, to create contrast, to create definition, that's something Gingrich slowly but then rapidly got Republicans in Congress to sort of embrace. It was the key to his rise. It was the key also to the ultimate success of the Republicans in getting the House in 1994.
Definition, contrarianism, voting against the other side, defining yourself. Two towering figures in your book from the 90s. You just mentioned Newt Gingrich. The other one is Bill Clinton, the president whom he faced off against when Newt Gingrich was Speaker of the House. And I take you back now to 1995. The government shutdown, the result of a standoff between Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, Republicans and Democrats in Washington, over the budget. Here's Bill Clinton, November 1995.
The government is partially shutting down because Congress has failed to pass the straightforward legislation necessary to keep the government running without imposing sharp hikes in Medicare premiums and deep cuts in education and the environment. Unfortunately, Republican leaders in Washington have put ideology ahead of common sense and shared values in their pursuit of a budget plan.
Now, Steve, we could talk about the policy choices that led to this shutdown, whether it was the environment or budget lines or how much money you're going to spend. It wasn't really about any of that. It was about ideological definition. It was about warfare.
Well, and it was about what a moment that was. And to put that in full context, that was supposed to be Newt Gingrich finishing off Bill Clinton and finishing off the Democratic Party. Because I said Gingrich came to the House in 78. When he came to the House, he was a backbencher, he was a gadfly, and his own party didn't even take him seriously. And by 1994, he leads them to the majority. And it was this shocking, traumatic event in American politics. Republicans erasing 40 years of Democratic rule. And Gingrich's reading on that was there was just this rising and unstoppable conservative tide that he had captured and channeled into the Republican Party, and they had control of the House. They would finish off Bill Clinton with a grand showdown in 1995, and it would be over the size of government. And one of the biggest features of it was Medicare. There were cuts, $270 billion in Medicare cuts that Gingrich wanted. And Bill Clinton basically said, I dare you to shut down the government over this. And this was going to be the test. And it revealed this sort of contradiction, I think, that's out there that has prevented either party from, in the modern era, getting a full consensus for a long time. And it's that conceptually people love conservatism, but they also like their Medicare. Mm. And that was what Bill Clinton tapped into, and he won that showdown politically.
And flash forward to the Tea Party movement, keep your government hands off my Medicare.
Same thing.
A billboard that we saw that struck a lot of people as not just weird, but also strangely historical. Well, here is one well-remembered moment from the 90s. I take you back to president, almost president at this point, Bill Clinton.
The answer to that question is I've never broken state law, and that when I was in England, I experimented with marijuana a time or two, and I didn't like it, and didn't inhale, and never tried it again.
Bill Clinton in the run-up to the presidential elections in 1992. The deceased late Christopher Hitchens went to Oxford with Bill Clinton, said the idea that Bill Clinton didn't inhale at Oxford was probably true because he knew firsthand that Bill Clinton chose to take his marijuana in edible form. That's what Hitchens used to say. He was no friend of Bill Clinton, by the way. We should stipulate that. We heard from Susan, who sent us an email. I believe that our political rifts started well before the 1990s. The Vietnam conflict was one of the most divisive issues since the Civil War, and we still have never recovered. And Not Witty tweets us on Twitter, I was in high school when Gingrich and company produced their Contract with America. I remember peers who had been pleasant with each other suddenly became antagonistic. Suddenly politics became a team sport. That experience is one of the reasons why I today and nonpartisan. Steve, you're nodding, and I think that type of reaction to sorting might sound familiar to you. I want to go back to the history in just a moment, but before we do, I want to get to a moment in tribalism, in politics, where we are right now. I want to talk about Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham, back during impeachment, was a member of the House. He was an impeachment manager. Right. He helped impeach Bill Clinton and then went before the Senate to make the case as a prosecutor that Bill Clinton should be removed from office because of the Monica Lewinsky experience. Now, Lindsey Graham has also made himself highly visible these last several weeks during the Brett Kavanaugh hearings. He's angrily defended Kavanaugh. He said the other day in the hearings, I think everybody saw it, I'm a single white male. People want me to shut up. And I won't shut up. And he was red-faced and he was furious on behalf of Brett Kavanaugh and presumably white men everywhere. But contrast that with the Lindsey Graham of 2016 and 2017 and even 2012. Here's Lindsey Graham at a roast dinner in 2017 poking some fun at Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, but making a point.
You're 46 years old. You've been the vice presidential nominee of the Republican Party. You're the Speaker of the House, the Republican-controlled House. You're smart. You know the budget backwards and forward. You have a good temperament and disposition in the judgment of Solomon. You are a dead man walking in his party.
Now, back in 2012, Lindsey Graham, the same Lindsey Graham, used to warn about the future of the Republican Party. He would quip to me and any reporter who would listen, "We can't make angry white guys fast enough to survive as a Republican Party of the future," meaning Republicans had to broaden their appeal to women, to minorities, to Hispanics. Flash forward to the Lindsey Graham of this week. "I'm a white male and I'm not going to take it anymore." Stunning. What does this transformation, the Lindsey Graham Hulkification in the Trump era, say to you about where we were and where we are?
Yeah, I mean, it tells me that the divide is deepening. And, you know, it tells me that the lines that were kind of drawn that you saw in the 2000 election, and I say that we've lived with since, they're only going deeper. And the moment you talked about there in 2012, after the 2012 election, there was, I think you remember this, certainly the Republican sort of establishment nationally looked at the Mitt Romney's loss to Barack Obama and concluded what Lindsey Graham did, that demographically, the way the country had been divided up for the last 15 or 20 years was not going to work for them long term. They came up with that autopsy report. They were going to change on immigration, all of this stuff. Donald Trump comes along and violates every tenet of this autopsy and wins. And I think it's not just that he won the general election, and that's a huge part of it, but the fact that he was able to sweep through the Republican parties, like the primaries, like he did in 2016, told Republicans like Lindsey Graham, and of course, easy to forget, but Lindsey Graham did run for president in 2016, one of the 16 or 17 Republicans who did.
And failed miserably.
And I think that's it. I think that lesson there of going head-to-head against Trump, of dismissing him completely at the beginning of that race. Graham called him a kook. He called him a bunch of things in 2016. And then watching how within the Republican world, how Trump resonated with their voters, it told them, boy, there's something about our own voters, our own party, our own tribe that we didn't quite understand. Maybe we didn't want to understand.
Graham did more than just name calling in a primary. He told Republicans, "We are finished if we nominate Donald Trump," that he is the death knell of this party. So what is Lindsey Graham thinking now? Is he thinking, "I have to win a Republican primary in 2020 in South Carolina where Donald Trump is popular, so I better get on the Trump train and that's all there is to it? The last gasps of the Republican Party, and I'm going to be a senator for one more term?" Or is he converted? What's he thinking?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's all sorts of theories about this, and I don't know, but I'll give you a couple of them that jump out at me. One is what you're saying. Yeah, he's got to worry about a Republican primary. Every Republican, one of the lessons of Donald Trump's rise and his enduring popularity with Republican voters, one of the lessons to Republican office holders is you are taking a major, major risk if you are seen as separating yourself from this president in your next primary, especially if you're Lindsey Graham and you already have a history of sort of being antagonistic towards the right here and there. So Graham has to worry about that. There's also the theory that, hey, part of this is Lindsey Graham trying to play the influence game. If you're friendly to Trump in public, if you sing his praises, if you change your tone on Trump the way he has, if you golf with him, maybe if you're Lindsey Graham and you have some issues, particularly on foreign policy and national security, this is a way to influence him. But I think one of the other lessons is again, Lindsey Graham looking at Trump in 2016 and saying this is absolute political suicide for the Republican Party to go down this road, and then seeing Donald Trump win the election. And I know it was narrow, but seeing that he won, I think tells Lindsey Graham, and just more broadly tells Republicans, that this tribalism is so much deeper than we realized it was. And it changes what you're able to do and what you can do politically.
Can it last is the question, given the demographics of this country. Lindsey Graham, I'll remind you one last time, said himself over and over, "We can't make angry white guys fast enough. We can't manufacture them fast enough to be a party of the future." I wonder if, when he closes his eyes at night, whether he's changed his mind about that or not. James sent us an email. "I frequently have yard signs for political candidates in my front yard, and because there are good candidates on both sides of the aisle, I usually have candidates from both major parties, and I am surprised at how often several of my neighbors express their genuine irritation with me that I can endorse candidates from both parties, very tribal, instead of an evaluation on the merits." And Steve, you're nodding because that does not sound surprising to you.
Yeah, well, what he's describing is ticket splitting. You know, in political science, the voters who go and they, Democrat for president, Republican for Congress, they split up the ballot. Just election to election, that the number of people out there who do that, who split their ticket, has been shrinking and shrinking. And you're looking at single digits right now. And that is just the rise of polarization and tribalism.
All right, let's get back in our way, way back machine, our red and blue way, way back machine. Go back in history with you, Steve Kornacki. So much of what your book is about. We talked about the Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, who I'm led to believe did not talk to you for this book, mm-hmm. although he certainly could have. When he was a young, rabble-rousing congressman who was willing to defy the normal rules of congressional decorum, in May of 1984, he delivered an insult on the floor of the House to then-time Speaker from Massachusetts, the legendary Tip O'Neill.
My point to the Speaker is, you, as you have pointed out to us again yesterday, are in charge of this House. If you are saying to me that your postmaster is incapable of delivering from one member to another the mail in the system you run, then I think you may want to appoint a commission to look into the post office.
Now, maybe a veiled insult there that might take a little bit of parsing, but give us the backstory and why Newt Gingrich was slinging an insult at the well-respected and legendary Tip O'Neill.
Yeah, that in hindsight, now you look back 30 years and you play that, you may say, what was the big deal? The big deal was Democrats had run the Congress at that point for 30 years. They were seen as the permanent majority. I mean, Republicans weren't just the minority party. They were buried deep. They weren't even close. You didn't go into an election saying maybe the Republicans will get it, maybe they won't. It was like maybe they'll get to 170 seats this time. You know, that was how deep in the minority they were. And here was Gingrich, who was in his third term from Georgia, baiting the Speaker of the House, who was at that point a 72-year-old old school Boston politician, Tip O'Neill, man of the House, baiting him into a fight on the floor of the House. O'Neill actually left the Speaker's rostrum, came down to the floor of the House to debate Gingrich.
And we have that very sound. Here's Tip O'Neill and his response.
My personal opinion is this. You deliberately stood on that well before an emptied House and challenged these people, and you challenged their Americanism. And it's the lowest thing that I've ever seen in my 32 years in Congress.
Mr. Speaker, if I may reclaim my time, let me say, first of all,
Mr. Speaker, I move we take the Speaker's words down.
Now, take the Speaker's words down as a little bit of procedure from the House, but it means a rebuke. It means that you've broken the rules. It means you've broken decorum. And that was the first time in the history that the words of the Speaker were taken down or stricken from the congressional record. Now, how did this moment define the fight for Newt Gingrich and the Republicans?
And this is the reason I focus on this moment in the book, because I think this is a turning point moment in Congress, in politics in general, certainly in the Republican Party. The voice you heard there that said, Mr. Speaker, I move to take the Speaker's words down, that was Trent Lott. Trent Lott was a Republican congressman. Mm. He was one of Gingrich's allies, and he recognized right away that in what O'Neill did there, he personally attacked Gingrich, the lowest thing, accused him of doing the lowest thing he'd ever seen. The parliamentarian, a Democratic appointee, had to rule against Tip O'Neill. It's essentially a rebuke, essentially a reprimand to the Speaker of the House. And then Newt Gingrich gets to keep talking, and he's talking about a McCarthyism of the left and the Democrat, all of this stuff. Closes his binder when he finishes, leaves the House chamber, and the Republican side stands and cheers. And reporters go and talk to Republican members after. And you have to remember, Gingrich, third term from Georgia, came there. Republicans thought he was a joke when he got to Congress. And now they have just watched him bait Tip O'Neill, the Speaker of the House, got him onto the floor of the House, got him into a debate, and got him reprimanded.
Mm.
And they stand and they cheer. And there's comments afterwards. Henry Hyde from Illinois, who was had been there for a long time, Republican at that point, he talked to the press afterwards about how amazing it was to watch Tip O'Neill get befuddled. And it was a joy. And Gingrich showed them what that can feel like, what that kind of partisan warfare can feel like.
Not just to win, but to make the other side lose, and to humiliate them.
And to feel the cheers of your side, because they heard from their voters. They heard from people watching this on TV telling them, why aren't you doing more of this? And that was that was the key to Gingrich's appeal to the grassroots. And they started to see, you know, maybe we'll get somewhere in this chamber. We've been in the minority for 30 years. We've been getting nowhere. Maybe if we do this, we'll get somewhere.
Steve Kornacki, let's go to 1992 and talk about Pat Buchanan and the rise not the rise, but the continuation, the resurgence of the Catholic right wing in the Republican Party and the Republican coalition. Now, Pat Buchanan was a news commentator at the time. He had made an unsuccessful bid to unseat incumbent George H.W. Bush for the Republican nomination for president. He ultimately rallied behind Bush in exchange for a prime speaking slot at that year's convention, where he delivered a speech that you say in this book, forgotten by some people, but really one of the most important touchstones in the history of tribalism that we're talking about.
There is a religious war going on in this country. It is a cultural war as critical to the kind of nation we shall be as the Cold War itself, for this war is for the soul of America. And in that struggle for the soul of America, Clinton and Clinton are on the other side, and George Bush is on our side.
There is a religious war for the soul of America. We are on the side of God, essentially. Our political opponents are, and I'm paraphrasing now because this is the subtext, on the side of evil. Evil. And Pat Buchanan is defining a religious war in extremely stark terms, and in terms that maybe hadn't been heard in American political discourse since the Civil War.
This is another one of those moments where I think when you talk about the divide becoming cultural and you talk about the which party you side with becoming a matter of identity, I think this was one of those moments, because you look at the Republican Party in 1992 nationally. There was still a Republican president. He was going to lose that fall. But George H.W. Bush still had a fighting chance that night in Houston at that convention. He'd won big in 88. Reagan had won big twice. And you think about the kind of message, the kind of personality that Reagan communicated, the great communicator, sunny optimist. You know, he was a very conservative person, but he also built it. He was sort of draped in this very sort of sunny, warm facade. And George H.W. Bush, the sort of gentlemanly New Englander, that kind of thing. And Buchanan here was putting out in the open this just stark cultural mess. Think about the language there, Clinton and Clinton. He's talking about Bill and Hillary like they're a law firm. He's talking about her as a radical feminist. He's talking about the radical pro-abortion wing of the Democratic Party. He is drawing a very, very dark and deep line culturally that the Republican leaders before then had really shied away from. And by the end of that week, by the way, in Houston, you even had, or by the end of the next week, Dan Quayle, the vice president, even started trying to distance himself from Pat Buchanan. But the message was out there. That speech really, I think, it told you had to pick sides.
We got a message from Travis on Facebook who says, there are issues that are non-negotiable, such as ending a life in the womb. It is a separate life worthy of living. I believe that is an issue that has polarized us, and all other issues are secondary. And Steve Kornacki, let's throw it back to the present and the seeds of this religious war that Pat Buchanan talked about. This last week in the fight over Brett Kavanaugh, I saw Republican conservative operatives on social media using language like this. In their view, what the Democrats are trying to do to Brett Kavanaugh is about one thing. They want the right to kill babies. Over and over, you heard and saw this language on social media. Pat Buchanan sowed these seeds, and now they have flourished.
Well, yes, abortion is a major part of the divide. And when we talk about the sorting out of the parties, think about this right now. The number of anti-abortion Democrats in the U.S. House, it depends how you define this. I think the number's down to like two right now. If you went back to the start of the 1990s, it was nearly 100.
Pennsylvania,
Democrats.
Ohio,
sure.
All over.
Yeah. But, you know, in 1992 was the year. One of the reasons Pat Buchanan made that speech in 92 was that the Democratic governor of Pennsylvania, Bob Casey, at that point, father of the current senator, pro-life Democrat, wanted to speak. Was not given a major spot at the Democratic convention, and the Republicans and Buchanan saw an opportunity to draw a line there. 92 was also the last time you had a major push on the Republican side to put pro-choice language into the Republican platform, or at least an acknowledgement of pro-choice views in the Republican Party. And Bill Weld, who was the governor of Massachusetts, showed up at that convention. He had the governor of Maine with him, a few other moderate liberal Republicans, and they were pretty much shut down on the floor in 1992. And it's one of those moments, you look at it now, You're not going to find a pro-choice Republican winning a national nomination. You're not going to find an anti-abortion Democrat doing it. They're totally sorted out on that issue.
Those lines have not just been drawn. They have been absolutely walled off and trenched, says Steve Kornacki. Will from Adelphi, Maryland, sent us an email. We must change the system to allow the emergence of other parties. I can't see that happening unless we move to a preferential voting system, which would allow other parties to prosper after one explosive election. We're going to talk with Steve Kornacki a lot more about how the political strife of the 90s can frame today's ideological battles. We'll be back in just a minute. This is 1A. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Are rent prices leveling off? What's the best job after college? And is our labor market actually healthy? Listen to Planet Money's daily podcast, The Indicator, to find out.
We're talking, for the most part, about what politicians said and did in the 1990s. So how did they define their ideologies for the American people? It's not just Washington that's polarized. We've been asking listeners for memorable moments from politics in the 90s, and here's one. Soon-to-be president. President Bill Clinton, June 1992, on the Arsenio Hall show. Remember him? Woof, 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 Arsenio Hall. Before that year, presidential candidates didn't really appear on nighttime talk shows at all. So that was something new. Talk about how politicians grappled with media coverage during those years. Steve, that was a moment not just because the president appeared on Arsenio Hall, but he seemed to offer an alternative to, gosh, even Pat Buchanan's speech. There is a religious war in this country, very stark, very serious, and a lot of Americans agreed with him. Here was Bill Clinton in sunglasses, just having a whole lot of fun, the guy you want at the party.
It was also the moment. That was June 1992 when Bill Clinton did the Arsenio Hall show. Bill Clinton was actually running not in first or second, but in third place in the presidential race at that point. First place was Ross Perot. Second place was Bush, the incumbent president. And third place, buried with about 25%, was Bill Clinton. And so they were his team. Remember, the Bill Clinton who emerged from the Democratic primaries in 92 was thought to be unelectable. He'd gone through the scandal about Jennifer Flowers. He'd gone through the scandal about avoiding the Vietnam draft. He'd gone through the I didn't inhale moment that sort of hardened this image of Slick Willie, the guy who's going to, you know, lawyerly try to scheme his way out of everything. And so they were trying, his campaign was to change his image. And he had this, you know, obviously winning personality, and they wanted to showcase it. And they wanted to get around interviews with, you know, traditional news interviews where every question was going to be about Jennifer Flowers and the draft and all of that. So here was a way. You go on a syndicated nighttime talk show like Arsenio Hall, which was very hot at that moment. You showcase a different side of your personality. And it was 92. It wasn't just Arsenio. 92 was the year media had been expanding in so many ways, and that media expansion really met up with politics, presidential politics. I mentioned Perot, who was running in first place at that point. The entire Perot phenomenon began in February 92 on the CNN show Larry King Live.
Larry King.
And Larry King would sometimes have politicians on and sometimes aging celebrities, and they'd spend an hour and they'd take calls. And Ross Perot was on in February 92, and he said, you know, if there are volunteers out there who will put me on the ballot in all 50 states, I'll run for president as an independent. And just from that, a movement sprung up organically across the country to do. In Texas, about 2 months later, volunteers submitted 254,000 signatures to get Ross Perot on the ballot, and he was running in first place by June. And he was doing talk shows. Clinton was doing talk shows. There was a Clinton-Jerry Brown primary debate on the Phil Donahue show, the syndicated daytime talk show. And George H.W. Bush, this was a generational aspect too. 68-year-old George H.W. Bush, the president, running for re-election. His spokesman said, after Bill Clinton did the Arsenio Hall show that night, well, We won't be doing anything like that. And Arsenio Hall went on his show the next night and just tore into Bush and went after him.
That was beneath the presidency.
Yeah.
It was beneath the presidency to go on a nighttime talk show where people goof around and make, goof adolescent jokes. That's not for a president. And Bill Clinton said, oh yes, it is.
And by the end of the campaign, Bush wasn't doing Arsenio by the end of the campaign, but he was doing, you know, morning shows on television. And even he was starting to sort of get the message.
Politicians now manage media in a very, very different way. Now going on a late night talk show is par for the course because people want you to display your personality. Barack Obama had a winning personality, an affable, nice guy, and used it to great political effect. Everywhere from Jimmy Fallon to Stephen Colbert, there isn't a show that Barack Obama didn't go on successfully. Donald Trump, in his campaign, did the same as well because he's extremely comfortable on live television, even if somehow less likable than maybe Barack Obama was. But the mores of how you reach the public have changed just radically. They changed completely since the moment when George H.W. Bush said, we're not going to lower the presidency by going on Arsenio Hall.
And I think, too, you can draw a line between, we were talking about Gingrich earlier, and the rise of Gingrich in that moment with O'Neill. What that moment came from was Gingrich looking for a way around what at the time were the dominant sort of media platforms. And they were just the broadcast networks. And Gingrich, third-term congressman from Georgia, said, I'm not going to be able to get my message out across ABC, CBS, NBC because they don't, you know, pay attention to me. He used C-SPAN. You know, C-SPAN was 5 years old in the early 1980s, and he used these late-night speeches on C-SPAN to seek out, find, and develop a relationship with a new audience. Draw a line from that and how Gingrich was able to build his career, his rise in the House around that. Fast forward to Donald Trump. What did Donald Trump do? Television, obviously a part of it, but really in the campaign, social media, Twitter. Donald Trump identified through Twitter a way to go around not just the news media, but the entertainment media as well that's so engaged in politics now, and to directly get his message across to voters to get around it. I see what Gingrich was doing in the 80s with C-SPAN and Trump was doing with Twitter, and I think there's a real common thread there.
Well, let's go back then in the way back machine one more time to 1999. Donald Trump, who was, people forget, was involved with politics even at the time. He flirted mentally and even in reality with presidential runs long before he was ever successful. He went on Meet the Press back in 1999 and had some thoughts about somebody that we've already talked about, Pat Buchanan, the insurgent right-wing politician in the Republican Party.
Look, he's a Hitler lover. I guess he's an anti-Semite. He doesn't like the blacks. He doesn't like the gays. It's just incredible that anybody could embrace this guy, and maybe he'll get 4 or 5% of the vote, and it'll be a really staunch right wacko vote. I'm not even sure if it's right. It's just a wacko vote, and I just can't imagine that anybody can take him seriously.
Donald Trump sounded then about Pat Buchanan how John McCain sounded about Donald Trump just a couple of years ago, calling his voters wacko birds. You know, Pat Buchanan was a candidate who supported a moratorium on new regulations, supported building a border wall, even said, and this is a quote from your book, we're going to make America great again. There is nothing wrong with putting America first. It is absolutely remarkable to hear Donald Trump speak about Pat Buchanan in this way in 1999, says a lot less about the men in question and a lot more about how the fringes of the party have become the center of it.
Right. What we call Trumpism now, we saw in the 1990s, and we saw it through Pat Buchanan. Pat Buchanan first ran in 92, as we mentioned earlier, against George H.W. Bush. He was seen as a protest candidate. Bush had raised taxes, done a couple other things that irked conservatives. So he had some success, but he was dismissed as just a protest candidate. 4 years later, he runs again in the 1996 primaries. He's written off at the beginning as having no chance. He ends up winning the New Hampshire primary. He beats Bob Dole there. He almost won the Iowa caucuses before that and scares the daylights out of the Republican establishment because he's running on this platform you described there, whether it's on immigration. There was also the economic nationalism. He talked about tearing up trade deals, reviving American manufacturing. He railed against multiculturalism, political correctness. He said, you know, that Western European heritage was being stripped away by liberal elites in this country. This was the Buchanan platform of 96. Republicans looked at it and they said, it's going to destroy our party. And they were stunned at how many voters in Republican primaries were getting behind him. It also attracted, as we saw with Donald Trump a generation later, when you put that kind of platform out there, you are going to attract some folks from the extreme fringes like David Duke, And David Duke aligned himself with Pat Buchanan, and Republicans said in 96, Buchanan is not repudiating him. And in 99-2000, Buchanan, here's another word right out of the Trump playbook, Buchanan declared the Republican process rigged.
Rigged.
And said, I'm leaving the Republican Party, I'm going to run for the Reform Party nomination. Perot had created this, and I'm going to run third party. And who stepped forward to oppose him for the Reform nomination? It was Donald Trump. And so Pat Buchanan's out there running on this platform that today we would call Trumpism, attracting support from people like David Duke. And here's Donald Trump standing up and saying, I'm a bulwark against this. I'm against this kind of extremism. I can't believe he won't repudiate David Duke. At one point, Trump takes a campaign visit. I put this in the book. He takes a campaign visit to something called the Museum of Tolerance in California. He emerges. He says, I wish Pat Buchanan would take a visit here. He might learn something.
Can you imagine Donald Trump taking a visit to the Museum of Tolerance today and what his base might say? Steve Kornacki, there's so much history in your book, but before we reach the top of the hour, I want to talk a little bit about where we were, but also where we are right now. We mentioned earlier in the hour having politicians take a little bit of responsibility for this tribalism. It's not something that just happened to America. There are forces, there's social media, things that happen in the economy that have all contributed to this. But in many ways, also, it has been strategy. You know, one of the attack lines, one of the themes of at least Republican politics through these years of the 90s, there's always been a suspicion of mainstream media among Republicans. You know, oh, it's mostly liberals writing at the New York Times and the Washington Post. The media is biased. And that was a criticism that may have had some currency and, in fact, may have even had some accuracy. Those accusations have morphed now. They've morphed into a president who, as we know, attacks the media as the enemies of the people, calls them all liars. Any negative story written about me is automatically false. He even told Leslie Stahl of CBS News 60 Minutes, I do it so that if you write something negative about me, people simply won't trust you. And I arrive at this point that the vilification of the media by Republicans and by this president isn't something that just happened. It's something that they engineered. It's something so that when a president finally came along and said, they're the enemies of the people, they're evil, they're out to destroy the America you loved, people were prepared to believe it. 30 years ago, they would have said, that's crazy.
Yeah, no, and I think you're exactly right that it's part of a much longer and broader story. And it's sort of the rise of national media, especially national television media, you know, really after World War II, basically, created a culture within media, and you know, an elite media culture, whatever you want to call it, that did tend to attract folks who were more, I think, you know, on the liberal side of things. And that became one of the sources of energy and sources of power for the conservative movement that kind of rose at the same time. Remember the old William F. Buckley line, you know, going back to the 1950s, I'd rather be governed by the first 200 names in the Boston phone book than by the faculty at Harvard University. That tension has always sort of animated conservatism. You saw with Spiro Agnew and Nixon. Hey, in 92, I think I have this in the book, George H.W. Bush, the closing days of his campaign, he believes he's been sunk by the media. He puts on a hat. He starts wearing it to his rallies. It says, annoy the media, reelect Bush. That became his closing message, essentially, in the campaign. And it's not a coincidence, I think, that one of Bush's media advisors in 88 and somebody who was always there to be giving him advice and counsel was Roger Ailes. And Roger Ailes, you know, took that jump from Republican politics into the news media. And in 1996, he saw that there was a massive audience that was out there, 20 million people a week who were listening to Rush Limbaugh on talk radio. You know, there was a massive audience out there that felt the news media looked down on them, didn't understand their interest, you know, was lecturing them constantly. And he created the Fox News Channel in 1996. And it was fair and balanced. And it spoke to conservative Americans largely who looked at the media that way. And Fox News took off like wildfire. And by 2001, number one cable network.
Enormously financially successful. And I don't mind saying with a great degree of misdirection in the entire premise, fair and balanced. It's fine to launch a network the way they did. They have been enormously successful. They did it based on the presence that the premise that everyone else is lying to you. But basically, the Republican Party line is the only thing that's true. And that has had an enormous effect on our polarization. Steve Kornacki, I want to thank you for joining us. It's been a fascinating hour. Steve Kornacki's book is The Red and the Blue, the 1990s and the Birth of Political Tribalism. He is MSNBC and NBC News national political correspondent. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for this. This was great fun.
Great to see you again. This show was produced today by Avery Kleinman. To learn more about Avery and the rest of the team, visit the website at 1A.org/staff. 1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I am Todd Zwillick. Joshua Johnson is back in this chair tomorrow. Thanks so much for listening. This is 1A.